From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. If you're living in Massachusetts, one day you might get a call like this.
We're following up on all cases of the novel coronavirus called COVID-19. One person who has recently been diagnosed with the virus has been in contact with you recently. This does not mean you have coronavirus or will necessarily get coronavirus. Do you have a few minutes to discuss what this might mean for you?
That's Krista Cass, a supervisor for the Massachusetts COVID-19 Community Tracing Collaborative, a contact tracing effort launched by the state in partnership with the nonprofit group Partners in Health. Now, Krista was giving us an example there of the kinds of things contact tracers might say to a person they call, a person who might have interacted with someone who tested positive for COVID-19. Now, successful contact tracing is critically important for controlling the pandemic and getting the economy up and running. It has been done before for different diseases, but never before at the scale needed across the United States to fight COVID-19. So this hour in Point, everything you wanted to know about contact tracing. And we will start with Krista Cass. As I said, she's a supervisor for the Massachusetts COVID-19 Community Tracing Collaborative. Krista, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you so much for having me here to describe what we're doing over at Partners in Health with the Community Tracing Collaborative.
So could you just tell me briefly, ideally, how is it supposed to work when someone tests positive for COVID-19? What happens next through the contact tracing program?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are Governor Baker and the state's humble and grateful partners. And it's our job as contact tracers to reach out to all individuals who have tested positive for COVID-19, identify their exposed contacts, and educate those individuals of what it means to be in isolation or quarantine. And as a follow-up component, we check in on those individuals with a simple phone call to monitor any changes, whether that be improvement or sometimes worsening of symptoms, and even discussing their possible resource needs.
So, Krista, let me just jump in here and ask you maybe a bunch of simpler questions. So someone tests positive for COVID-19, and the first thing that the contact tracers need to do is they need to find who that person came in contact with over how long a period of time?
Yeah, it can actually be quite a long period of time depending on when they received their diagnosis and when they were tested and when they received their diagnosis. So we look at the test date as one item to discuss, and then we have to ask them about when they had their first symptom, because as we're all aware, there's a large incubation period where even though they may have not tested positive in a week, they may have been symptomatic for those 7 days. Mm-hmm. So we trace it back from 2 days prior to the first day of symptom to this conversation.
Okay. So a long period of time. You can imagine that in that period of time, people, even under our social distancing orders, might have interacted with a lot of folks. Like, are you contacting everyone that they might have just walked down the street and passed? Or maybe they did have to go grocery shopping and they stood next to the cashier for a couple of minutes?
Yeah, of course. So we're looking at contacts that they've been within 6 feet for more than 10 minutes. So if you're just walking by someone on the street, there is less likelihood of transmission. But if you're having, you know, very close contact with somebody and close is within 6 feet, that's somebody that would be a key interest of ours.
Okay. So so it's not literally everyone that you might have passed, but it still could be a fairly significant number. And then when you call people up, you said a little earlier that you have to walk them through a couple of things. One is you've got to let them know the news, right, that they may have interacted with someone who tested positive. That must come as a shock, just that news in and of itself.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, there are two types of people that we're contacting. You have the person who recently tested positive for COVID-19, and that's a conversation which you're calling them, and more often than not, they are aware that they've been diagnosed with COVID-19. But then there's the other person that you're contacting who has no idea that they were exposed. And that's the conversation where right after you call them and they answer the phone and we tell them who we are, there's a period of shock because many people, the first thing they say is, what do you mean? I've practiced the best social distancing practices. You mean one of the very few people I come into contact exposed me? And it's, we see a whole combination of different emotions, mm-hmm. shock, frustration, questioning, paranoia, worry, concern, fear. It's a very real comment.
Yeah. So then after that, I imagine that's a major portion of the conversation that you're not going to just breeze through in a minute or two. After that, you try to set them up with supports from the state, because I presume that the contact tracers are telling that person that they need to self-quarantine almost immediately.
Oh, yes. So as I said earlier, one of the big things is the resource need function is, or part of our investigation is so important. We call it a home assessment. And it's easy enough to ask me to self-isolate or quarantine. I don't have children that depend on me. I have cats. I'm fine. I'm financially stable. And I have enough food to get by in the event I had to isolate. But the thing is, that's not the case for most individuals. And I talk to my contact tracers and investigators all the time, and I ask them to put themselves in a positive patient's shoes. Because imagine being diagnosed with COVID-19 or any scary disease at this point. The first thing that I would want to do is I would want to hug someone just to know I wasn't alone. But the very next thing you hear after being diagnosed with COVID-19 is you have to isolate yourself from others. And most of the people we're talking to, they're not, you know, all that independent. They have people that depend on them. We have single parents with children that they need to take care of, elderly parents that depend on them. Some people don't have enough food or money to get by through the next 2 weeks. And that's what's become that secondary goal of what we're doing at the Community Tracing Collaborative with Partners in Health. While we are absolutely trying to increase awareness by contacting positive individuals and exposed contacts, educating them about the importance of staying home, the second thing we're doing, we're following up. We check on every case to make sure they're doing okay. And it's that relationship with both the contact tracer and case investigator with the actual case contact and how we tie them into the state resources to make sure that they can make it through and feel supported through this period of time.
Hmm. It sounds like it's going to take a lot of people to do this work, because it's a very sort of human intensive effort. Does Massachusetts have enough contact tracers to do this?
We have many. I think that's the best answer. We could always use more. We're growing as an organization each and every day. In response to Governor Baker's call, Partners in Health received over 5,000 applications the first day alone. To date, we've received over 20,000. We've recruited an incredible workforce almost overnight. We train them up to speed. And the most amazing thing about this is we did this all remotely. We abided by the social distancing guidelines. We've never met one another, yet we've pioneered a process to just address the situation at large and really be there for our commonwealth.
Well, Krista Cass is supervisor at the COVID-19 Community Tracing Collaborative in Massachusetts. She spoke to us today from Boston, Massachusetts. Krista, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Meghna.
So that's an example of what is happening in one state. Massachusetts was one of the first to launch a COVID-19 contact tracing program. But let's expand our view nationally here. And joining us now is Andy Slavitt. He is former administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He served in that position under President Obama. He's host of a new podcast called In the Bubble. And earlier this week, he and former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb released a letter requesting Congress to fund a public health proposal to safely reopen the economy, and that included hiring 180,000 contact tracers across the country. Andy Slavitt, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Megan. Good to be here.
So first of all, just describe to me, why is it that contact tracing is so important for fighting the pandemic and, you know, getting the economy back on its feet?
Well, we're not going to be in a situation in the near term where we have a silver bullet that eradicates COVID-19. So the way we need to be thinking is, instead of eradicating it, we want to contain it to some very small amounts. Think about what we've been living through, Meghna, as a forest fire. It's been raging. It's been out of control. We've been trying to get our arms around it. And what we want to do is we want to convert that into some small campfires that have stones around them and all the safety procedures, so that as soon as in Boston or anywhere in the country, we can immediately, when we see a positive test, figure out where the breadth of that infection is spread, warn everybody, and help make sure that those folks isolate. And that will, if that happens, then people are going to start to feel safe again to go to work, to get on airplanes, and to go about their normal life.
Mm. And so what you heard Krista describe and what's happening in Massachusetts, is that the kind of effort that you imagine we need nationally?
And this isn't something that we just made up. This is tried and true for measles, for smallpox, for HIV AIDS. It is, you know, if anybody saw the movie Contagion, you know, they remember that the work that she was describing, very much the work that has to be done. It's hard when you have a disease that's so infectious, but it really is helpful to people, because I think one of the first things people think about when they hear that they're diagnosed positively is, oh my God, who did I infect? Mm. Who else did I get sick? And if someone could provide the resources for you to systematically go through and answer that question and make sure everybody's safe, then I think people really will welcome that.
Hmm. Now, you've written, you and Scott Gottlieb have written that we need 180,000 contact tracers across the United States. Why that number in particular?
So the work we did, so first of all, Scott Gottlieb, who's a Republican, and I, who am a Democrat, co-led this, and with 14 others, including some of the most important scientists in the country, and people from both parties. Real statement of unity that hopefully the Congress and the White House will respond to. The number of people that needed really is directly related to how hard that work is. That we just started. I can come back after the break and tell you how we thought about that.
Yeah, please do, Andy. And thanks so much for noting that the music is there, which means we got to take our first break here in just a second. We are exploring this hour everything you wanted to know about contact tracing and why it is so important as a next step in fighting the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about contact tracing, what it is, how it works, some concerns around technology and contact tracing, and why it's so important to get the economy going again. I'm joined today by Andy Slavitt. He is former administrator of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid. He served in that position under President Obama. He and former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb released a letter this week asking Congress to fund a public health proposal to safely reopen the economy, and that proposal included hiring 180,000 contact tracers. So, Andy, before the break, you were about to tell us why that particular number is what you want the nation to aim for.
So it takes about a team of about 3 to 4 people, an average of 3 days, for every new case. And that may sound like a lot, but try this. Try thinking about it. I interviewed Seth Doan, who is a CBS correspondent in Rome who had been diagnosed with COVID-19. And I asked him if he could remember all the people he'd come into contact with since he'd been diagnosed. And he tried, and he named some. The talking to a week later, who we had breakfast with in New York. And I just asked him simply, after you had breakfast with Seth and you didn't know that he was positive, who did you see? What did you do next? And he told me he went into his office, which had 18 people in it, and he went into a conference room and all of them fist bumped because they believed that that was safer. His mother in an elder care facility later that night. And I gave up right at that point because I thought, wow, how do you trace all of those things in a painstaking, systematic way? So it does take a lot of legwork. It does take a new workforce. It also takes the ability to give say if they want to socially isolate, can't do that at home. And so we've also called for using the hotel and motel inventory that is wide open in this country right now to do that for people who want to comfortably self-isolate, and then also to make sure that they have some form of income replacement.
So that's the sort of the three prongs of the plan that you and Scott Gottlieb have put together. But I just got to go back to one thing, Andy. The contact tracing also requires robust testing in order to find out who's been infected to begin with. And we're still not there. The two go hand in hand.
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I think what we're trying to do is prevent the country, get the country out of the mode of thinking serially about the problem of the moment. And then we solve that problem and then go, oh, let's start thinking about the next problem. And so we're asking is to start funding the hiring of these contact tracers. At the same time, we're ramping up our testing capability, because if you can test but you can't contact trace, you really can't protect people. And of course, contact tracing without testing is a little bit of clutching in the dark. Yeah. So we think this is something we need to get ahead of. We've been chasing this epidemic. It's now time for us to get ahead of it.
How close or how much overlap is there between your proposal and the White House's three-phase plan that it released, I think, last week or recently to reopen the economy?
Well, interesting thing is it both provided input into that plan prior to being released. And, you know, it is a plan that has, I think, all the right elements in the framework, but it doesn't have the details of how to do it, how to get as many tests as you need, how to do the various activities. So what we're doing in this letter that we proposed to Congress, we're drilling down at the next level and saying, this is what we need to do next. So we've had preliminary conversations with the White House since writing the letter. They reviewed it. You know, I think they hopefully will view this as nonpartisan, given all the people who signed it. They and Congress will take it seriously and put some money into the next funding bill for it.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what those preliminary conversations were? I mean, what specifically is the White House telling you?
Well, I think we tried to do is figure out what concerns do people have? What concerns do ordinary, everyday Americans have with contact tracing? And then what are the political concerns that people have on the political left and the political right? And to try to be responsive to them. And indeed, I think there are people who would be concerned if this were a mandatory program, if this was a program that they were having their civil liberties taken away from them. And I think particularly on the political right, but certainly people on the left, wanted to make sure that that's something that was there. And I think we addressed that pretty nicely. You know, I think people on the left, for the most part, their concerns are around equitability. I don't know if that's the right word. Equity, I guess, is the word I'm really looking for. Sorry about that. The tests and the contact tracers don't just show up in communities that have means, but that we make sure that this is distributed equitably. So we try those two things as well. But for the most part, other than those two concerns, I think we have a very much a proposal that I think all sides can support. It does take money, and there's a lot of things competing for money, as you know, in these bills. So Congress is going to have to decide what's most important.
Right. I mean, but I think the proposal is something like $46 billion, which, yes, it is money, but in comparison to the several trillion that Congress has been able to put forth to help the United States thus far, doesn't it seem like all that much, Andy? But hang on here for just a second. I want to actually now bring into the conversation Caitlin Rivers. She joins us from Baltimore. She's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and a professor in the Department of Environmental Health and Engineering. And her research focuses on improving epidemic preparedness and response. She's also co-author of A National Coronavirus Response, A Road to Reopening, that she wrote along with former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb. Professor Rivers, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So could you describe to us, first of all, how different in scale and ambition a national COVID-19 contact tracing program would be in comparison to contact tracing that we've done before for other diseases?
Well, again, as you say, contact tracing is something that our public health departments do all the time for all sorts of diseases, sexually transmitted diseases, whooping cough, measles. And so this is something that we know how to do very well. But those outbreaks are generally very limited in scope and geography and time. In contrast, the coronavirus is a pandemic. We're facing it in all of our communities. There are thousands of cases diagnosed every day. And so our contact tracing capabilities would have to scale in order to meet that need. And so it is a really big undertaking, but this is the tool, this is the approach that's going to allow us to safely move from everyone having to stay home into a more targeted intervention that allows us to reincorporate some community activities.
And is it best deployed through the states, through local departments of public health?
I think so. Our public health system in the United States is led at the state and local level. That's where our capacities are, and that's where the boots on the ground work happens. There are important components at the federal level as well, but those community-oriented activities are really conducted through state and local health departments. And so I think it's right that we allow those to scale up and to make use of their expertise.
Okay. I'm just curious, and forgive me for asking a bunch of nuts and bolts questions, but I think a lot of people want to know how this might work. So for the folks that a contact tracer calls up, would that person or those people be required to be tested?
It's going to vary by jurisdiction. Okay. Right now, given limitations on our testing capacity, those people will most likely be asked to remain at home. If they go on to develop symptoms, that's a different story. Then they might be more likely to receive a test. But if you are at home, you're doing fine at home, then that is sufficient for many jurisdictions.
I got it. Okay. And so what else do we need to know about ideally how this would work? Because it seems like we have some examples internationally. Singapore keeps coming to mind because they had a fairly robust contact tracing program in place before COVID-19 struck. Nevertheless, we are seeing little flare-ups even in places like Singapore.
That's right. Singapore, South Korea, there are multiple examples of countries that have used contact tracing to effectively control their outbreak. But control in this case does not mean driving transmission to zero. It's unlikely that we will have that option available to us until we get a vaccine. But in the meantime, what we have is contact tracing. And we do know from the experiences of those countries that have used it successfully that it can be very effective in controlling transmission. And again, right now we are all staying home to slow the spread. But we would like to be able to get to a place where we are able to do more targeted interventions to stop transmission. And it's contact tracing coupled with diagnostic testing that will allow us to make that transition safely.
Okay, so let's talk for a moment. And Andy, I'll bring you back in here for a second. But Professor Rivers, so it seems as if effective contact tracing takes a lot of people. That's what we've been talking about, getting on the phone, spending the time, tracking folks down, having long conversations with them. So obviously, there's the question of whether technology would help speed this process. What role do you see technology playing in contact tracing?
I think it's really important that we ask those questions and investigate the role of contact tracing. Technology and contact tracing, rather. There's new apps that are being developed and a lot of important innovation happening in that space, but I don't think we have all the details nailed down yet. This is not a technology that we've brought to bear for contact tracing at this scale before in the United States. And so I think there are open questions about how it would connect to the public health infrastructure, how we would manage privacy. There's details that need to be worked out.
Andy Slavitt, what do you think about that? Because it seems as if you want to scale quickly, we've got those tools all in our pockets with the smartphones.
You know, I think I first very naively believed that technology was going to solve this problem for us when I saw South Korea and talked to the people at Google and Apple, and they kindly, but I think a little bit reluctantly, agreed that their phones could be used here. I think we also dropped a poll to see what were Americans' attitudes towards having their movements traced and their contacts traced, and it was mixed. There was a narrow majority that were willing to do this, and an even greater number if you reminded them of Professor Ripper's point that it allowed people to get back to work more quickly. But there's still a very sizable minority of people who were not comfortable. And, you know, I think in a liberal democracy, you have to do things different than you do in places where they're have the ability to be a little bit more authoritarian. So it's very likely that the technology will be rolled out on an opt-in basis, mm-hmm. meaning people will have to select it. And once that happens, I think the numbers start to get problematic. I mean, just to give you an example, if only 40% of people opt in, which I think is a very large number, then you're only going to catch about 16% of the cases, because you need both the person who is infected and the person that they contacted with to have opted in. So I think the technology can be a tool. It can help jog our memories of who we've been in contact with and so forth. But I don't think we can avoid the big investment in the legwork and in the people.
Yeah. So we're going to talk in a few minutes about the details of what Apple and Google are considering doing with the phones themselves. And there's also all those app developers out there. But Caitlin, do we have examples on how technology can be used well? Because, again, I keep thinking about South Korea and Singapore, because beyond even just the contact tracing, I understand that they use technology to check in on people, sending them links every once in a while through text messages saying, like, you know, tap this link to confirm where you are. It can get a little big brothery, but is that a price that we have to pay to protect the public health?
I think you're right. There are different approaches to how to incorporate technology into contact tracing. I think the example that has been on everyone's mind is to use it to identify and notify contacts. So if you have been near another phone, maybe your phone could ping their phone and let you know that you had an exposure. And I think that's where a lot of the concerns come from. But as you just mentioned, there is another use of technology, which is to help people stay connected. That's what we use phones for all the time. And so I do see a lot of potential to allow either apps or just basic text messages, basic phone calls to allow public health to check in on people. How are you doing? Do you need to visit a doctor? Do you need any supplies at home? Do you need new medications? That's something we do all the time. And that's the kind of support we want to be able to provide to people. So I do think that's a really important opportunity.
Andy Slavitt, what do you think about that? Andy?
I think, again, we're going to need to I think we're going to, ideally, in a perfect world, everybody would use them, because everybody is as concerned, not just for their safety, but the people that they've come into contact with. You know, in other countries like Italy, they've done a really nice job making people feel cared for who have COVID-19, who are, make sure they don't get bored and so forth. So I think there's a way it can be done, but I think you have to overcome a certain amount of public distrust. Distrust of government, distrust of technology companies. We asked the question, who are you most likely to trust of a number of different people? Local health commissioners and local health departments are people that they're more likely to trust than either the federal government or technology companies. So I think that maybe there's a way to get there.
Well, we're going to talk more, again, specifically about what how technology could be used and the privacy concerns around it. But Andy, let me just swing back to the human contact tracers that you say, both you and Professor Rivers say, that we definitely need. I'm seeing reporting here from NPR. They contacted all 50 states and the District of Columbia, got data back from 41 states and Washington, that right now on the ground across the United States, there's some 7,300 workers who do contact tracing. Plans for the states to surge to 35,000 or so. That's well short of the 180,000 that you estimate that we need, Andy.
Yeah. Well, so first of all, there are a few different estimations out there.
Okay.
And we think our 180,000 number is kind of right in the middle. You know, there are estimations, credible estimations, that are as low as 100,000 and credible estimations as high as 250,000. And, you know, we won't know until we know how many cases we have. So there's no question that the reason the numbers are where they are is because they don't have the money from the federal government, and their budgets are a mess to be able to do that. But the importantly, we wrote this, our proposal, as a refundable block grant, so that a state could submit a plan and say, these are the number of cases we estimate. But if it comes in lower, and they don't need that many people, that the money would revert back to the federal treasury. And that way, we're trying to help Congress get around the problem of guessing too high or too low.
Okay. Professor Rivers, I mean, how many people do you think we're going to need nationally for this?
Yeah, our group at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, in partnership with the Association of Territorial and State Health Officials, estimated around 100,000 additional mm-hmm. contact tracers would be needed. We estimated that looking at the experiences of New Zealand and Singapore and Wuhan, China, which had a large outbreak, and seeing what resources that they needed. But I agree with Andy that we have never faced a situation like this before, and so we don't know exactly what our resource needs are. I think we should be thinking big, because if there's one lesson we've learned from this outbreak, it's that we don't want to fall behind.
Absolutely. Well, Professor Caitlin Rivers and Andy Slavitt, hang on here for just a second. They are helping us understand all we need to know about contact tracing and why it's such an important tool to help beat back the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be looking into the question about why so many of us are always asking, what day is it? What time is it? Has it been a week? Has it been a month? Has it been a year? What is it about this pandemic that is warping our sense of time and the passage of time? So that's what we're going to look at tomorrow, and we want to hear from you. Are you experiencing this? Has time been slowly dragging by for you, or maybe it's somehow weirdly compressed? Has your sense of what time means even changed? Do you ask yourself, what day is it? More than once a day, I do. So tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show, where we'll be looking at the physics and the physiology of time. Today, we are talking about the importance of contact tracing as a means of really pushing back the COVID-19 pandemic and getting the country back on its feet economically. I'm joined by Andy Slavitt. He's the former administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, served under President Obama. He's also host of a new podcast called In the Bubble. And Caitlin Rivers joins us. She's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. And now joining me in the studio is Dori Scheimer, On Point producer, who's been keeping track of some of the questions that On Point listeners have been sending us online. So, Dori, what have listeners been wondering about?
Ronald Holt asked us on Facebook, how would an app know if I'm with my phone at the time someone came near it? For example, if I leave my phone in the car while I'm in the supermarket and someone parks next to me, how does the app know I'm not actually near the person?
Okay, so that's at least one of the, I suppose, a lot of questions about technology we're getting.
Definitely. And then this is a practical how we could get more contact tracers and also solve another problem that the government needs to address right now. Julie Hall on Twitter asked us, why not have the census takers double as contact tracers?
Okay, so Andy Slavitt, actually, that's a pretty practical question. What do you think about the idea of turning census takers, once the census is complete, into contact tracers?
You know, the jobs are actually not that different. And look, I think the one thing we know is that there's no shortage of people looking for jobs. And by the way, there's no shortage of people looking to help.
Right.
Probably the most frequent question I get to be helpful here. So I don't think getting the workforce will be that big of a challenge. So the first question, which is a fine question, but we all have to remember technology is just an aid. Technology doesn't solve things for us. Technology helps us by providing a list of where we've been in contact with. We obviously have to review that list and say, hey, wait a minute. No, for those 3 hours, I wasn't near my phone. And so you eliminate those. But it makes it easier to remember where if you're like me, I can't tell you where I was last Monday or last Tuesday. So it would give me a little bit of a help.
Right. OK, so we are now going to really dig into the details of what technology might help or how it might help with contact tracing. And joining us from New York is Andy Greenberg. He's senior writer for Wired, covering security, privacy, and hacker culture. And we've got links to his reporting at onpointradio.org. Andy Greenberg, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so first of all, what have both Apple and Google proposed that they might do with actual smartphones themselves to assist with contact tracing?
Well, it's not just what they proposed. They're actually going to be releasing a beta of a system this week, rolling out to all of their phones, their mobile operating systems, Android and iOS, that can be basically like tapped into by apps that are built by health agencies at the national or state level. And so what the phones will do in this Google and Apple joint system, and they're collaborating on this, is the phones will constantly generate these codes and broadcast them via Bluetooth to any nearby phones that are also running the app. So these codes will change every 10 to 15 minutes, so they won't help anybody to track your movements or anything. But then if you spend a certain amount of time in proximity of another phone, that amount of time and distance is going to probably be tuned by the agencies, the health agencies that are implementing this. But if you, say, spend 10 minutes within 6 feet of somebody else, then both of your phones are going to record each other's rolling codes. And then those codes are stored on the phone. If later one of those people is diagnosed as COVID-19 positive, they can tell their app that they're now infected, and the app uploads all their codes to a server, and then the server will then send out those codes to everybody else using the app so that their app on their phone, just on their device, can tell them you potentially crossed paths, you potentially were in contact at some point in the last 2 weeks with somebody who's infected.
Okay, so a lot of questions in what you just described, Andy. First of all, we're still talking about an opt-in system, right? Where if a person would have to first download an app that accesses this new information that phones, that Apple and Google are allowing the phones to give out. And second of all, what about concerns of spoofing, for example? Like, what if there are malicious actors out there who might want to just like freak people out and say, I've got COVID, and have the app send out the alert? Would that be possible?
Yeah, I mean, the first things to say about the privacy of this app are that, yes, it's opt-in. Second, it doesn't actually track your location. It doesn't track any GPS location for anybody. Third, it doesn't actually upload any data at all from the vast majority of people's phones unless they are diagnosed as COVID-19 positive. So for anyone who's not COVID-19 positive, everything stays on their phone. It is truly private for the vast majority of people, and mostly private for even those COVID-19 positive people as well, if the app is implemented correctly. But you raise also this point of how do we prevent people, trolls and jerks, from declaring themselves COVID-19 positive just to scare their neighbors? Or, you know, what if they put their phone on their dog and let it run around the park and then try to make everybody think that they came into contact with an infected person just as a prank or something? The answer to that seems to be that healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, and people working in labs doing these doing the COVID-19 testing will give patients a code that they can put into their app. And only with that code, that confirmation code, maybe shared with a kind of QR code, will users of the app be able to declare themselves COVID-19 positive. So you're going to need help. You're going to need help from like a kind of confirmer, you know, in the healthcare system, to tell the app that you're positive. You won't be able to do it just as a prank or just based on your own kind of paranoia or hypochondria.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. So perhaps some protection there. But should we talk about Bluetooth for a second here? Kind of glitchy. Andy Slavitt pointed out earlier that people are already asking questions of, like, it's both glitchy and it can go through walls at short distances. I mean, and how meaningful is that if phones are talking to each other, even though people weren't actually in the same room together? Are there concerns around that?
There definitely are concerns. I mean, one of the first things I heard when I was writing about Google and Apple system is that I see my neighbor's Bluetooth devices and downstairs in my apartment building all the time. Does that mean that I'm going to, you know, be declared as, you know, in contact with them when in fact there's a whole floor of the building in between us? And when I put this question to people building these systems and to Google and Apple, they say that they can, with some success, tell the difference between people who are in the same room and people who are in adjacent rooms or have something between them. They're going to monitor the signal strength, essentially, of Bluetooth to both tell the proximity of people, but that also acts as a pretty good proxy, as a pretty good, you know, indicator of whether there is something blocking and weakening the signal between people as well, whether that's, you know, the wall of a car, as the caller earlier asked about, or walls between, you know, rooms of a building or a floor. So they're somewhat confident that they can determine who is actually in contact with each other, who is actually sharing airspace. But of course, there will be false positives. And and Apple and Google are, you know, not claiming to have built a perfect system here, just one that can offer another data point, really.
Right. So our phones are already throwing out tons of information about us every second of the day. We are living in a world of surveillance capitalism, as it's called. This seems to be another moment where, on the one hand, for the good of the public health, our phones could be throwing out even more information. But on the other hand, once you let that genie out of the bottle, it will be almost impossible to get it back in, Andy Greenberg. I mean, I just wonder, like, there have to be immediate privacy concerns or the thought about, well, what happens a year from now or 2 years from now when lots of apps start using this information that may have nothing to do with COVID-19? How can we control that?
Well, I think, you know, I wouldn't say that the privacy protections of the system are perfect, but they're pretty darn good. So, as I said, for the vast majority of people, nothing will ever be uploaded from your phone. It's only for people who are COVID-19 positive that they will agree, they'll opt in, they'll, you know, push the button to upload all of their contact codes to a server. And then that server, if the app is designed right, still won't be able to identify who the people are who is COVID-19 positive. But I don't know if I trust, you know, health agencies at the state level or even the national level to build apps that don't accidentally or on purpose correlate those codes with people's IP addresses on their phones to identify COVID-19 positive people. So that is a concern. But the concern there is that health agencies will learn who's COVID-19 positive, which is probably something they want to learn. And maybe we want them to know. For, you know, other kinds of concerns, the privacy perils here are somewhat limited. I mean, there may be a case where advertisers put tons of Bluetooth beacons in stores and try to use this in a somewhat evil way to track us, but they'll only be able to track people who are COVID-19 positive, and they'll only be able to track them for the last 2 weeks. So, you know, the 2 weeks of codes that are actually, you know, collected and used to measure their, you know, recent potential infections of other people. So the kind of malicious uses of this are somewhat limited, and they're very scandal prone. So I would not say that the Google Apple method is actually a huge privacy risk. In fact, they've taken a pretty conservative approach, and they're fighting currently with some European governments that want a far more centralized and in some ways more invasive system, but one that will give the government more information. Apple and Google have opted to do something that doesn't give the government very much information. And in the hopes, I think, that they'll avoid privacy scandal themselves, but also that there'll be more adoption of this because people won't be afraid of it. Right. And as I think Andy Slavitt was saying, we're going to need a huge number of people to adopt this for it to work.
So the very fact that Apple and Google are already in a fight with some European governments is exactly the reason why I think we ought to be asking robust questions now about what uses this technology or even these slight tweaks could be put forth for in even the very near future. If there's anything we know about technology, is that tomorrow is very different from today, and creative entrepreneurs will find ways to use the information that they're allowed to get their hands on. But Caitlin Rivers, you've been listening very patiently here. I was just wondering what your response is to what Andy Greenberg's reporting about how we might use technology and some of the concerns or maybe assurances around them.
There's a trade-off between these privacy-focused systems, which could be useful for alerting individuals to their risk and maybe reducing the overall risk generally. But in order to use contact tracing for epidemic control, you have to do a pretty complete job of it. You have to reach nearly everyone and get them to stay home, or else people will still be circulating in the community while they're infectious. And so when we're considering the use of these apps, I think we also need to tie it to the utility of public health. I'm not suggesting that we override people's rights in order to optimize on public health. That's not what I intend to say. But more that I don't know that these apps that focus specifically on privacy could complete the work of public health if they're not connected to that system.
Right. Well, Andy Slavitt, we've got a couple of minutes left here. I just want to do a little reality check. We've talked ideally about how many contact tracers we'd need across the country, how much it might cost, how technology could be folded in as a safe and effective tool to reach this important goal. Do you think it's actually going to happen? And the reason why I ask is we're already seeing fights emerge in Congress over giving states additional funding for their budgets, for example. Or we had to go through a couple of rounds of funding for small businesses and problems with that, the rollout of that funding. Just a reality check, because you have been very honest and clear on your Twitter feeds over the past several weeks about your frustrations with the federal government. Do you think that we're going to get a robust contact tracing program launched in the United States?
Well, look, in the context of congressional fights, we have a Congress that's been incredibly unified. And of course, they're going to scrap and position and negotiate about everything from how much money to what the priorities are. But I do think we will not be able to have the economy back and, quite frankly, our social relationships back until we can demonstrate to the public that we can open up more safely. So realize that, A, this money will help people do that and get the economy going. B, it is a stimulus in itself, both for the hotel industry, it creates jobs and so forth. And third, that it's a as you said earlier, Megla, it's a small price to pay relative to continuing to keep ourselves shut down and so forth. So I'm hopeful. I don't know whether they'll give exactly the amount of money we requested or suggested. I think they're going to do their analysis, but I'm very hopeful and maybe even a little bit cautiously optimistic that they will include funding for this purpose.
Cautious optimism is always welcome, Andy. But at the same time, right now, we have states that are in the process of opening up even in the absence of a fully fledged contact tracing program. Is that a concern?
It is. But, you know, I'm of the view, maybe a minority view, that it's actually not the politicians that will decide the fate of the people in their state, but it's the people themselves. I think people, by and large, will go out and consume things, and businesses will hire people when they feel safe. Again, as long as people don't, some people will certainly listen to their governors, but we've evidenced that many, many other people will not go out and start sharing popsicles again until they are feeling that their family's safe again. They've sacrificed already 5 weeks. We've actually seen that there's even no difference in how much income someone makes relative to their ability and willingness to sacrifice, because people do put the health and safety of their friends, their family, themselves, their community, then a lot of things. So I think the politicians aren't going to dictate our future. We are.
Well, Andy Slavitt is the former administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He served under President Obama, host of the new podcast, In the Bubble. Andy Slavitt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great being here.
And Andy Greenberg, senior writer at Wired, covering security, privacy, and hacker culture. Andy, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Caitlin Rivers, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and a professor in the Department of Environmental Health and Engineering. Professor Rivers, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.